the Adam and Carrie monster.
All right. So we left off talking about self-will and self-centeredness and not being able to like wish our own selfishness and self-centeredness away, right? We said that our troubles are our own making, meaning that, you know, I don't have to change anybody else in order for my life to change. I simply have to change me. Sounds really, really, really simple, but also quite difficult. But that's also like, that's a hell of a lot of hope, because I don't have to live my life being unhappy because of other people. You know, that I can have absolute happiness and contentment simply by changing my perception of things or taking action. And it says at the very end, we were talking, I said, neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying our own power. We had to have God's help. So how do we get God's help? I mean, like, ultimately, okay, now we've made all of our diagnosis. Up until this point, we have now thoroughly diagnosed ourselves. We have acknowledged where our issues lie. We see what it is that's going on within us that is causing our trouble. You know, we realize that we have this problem with alcohol. We realize we have this problem with lack of power. We realize that this problem of lack of power translates into us being jerks most of the time. We make decisions based on self that place us in a position to be hurt, and we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation. But at some time in the past, we made a decision based on self that placed us in a position to be hurt. Okay, so now we see all this. So what do we do about it? Right? So it says, here's the how and the why of it. First of all, we have to quit playing God. Okay. It didn't work. Do I believe that? Do I believe that playing God doesn't work? I mean, that's a huge consideration. Because I don't know about you, but my fourth column on my resentment inventory was littered with playing God. Right? The delusion that I have some sort of control, the delusion that people should live the way that I want to, or the delusion people should behave the way I want to, think the way I want to, or the delusion that I have any right to have any demands on anybody in general. Right? So the thing here is, I mean, do I really believe that? And it says that next, we decided hereafter in the drama of life, God was going to be our director. Now, what does that mean? Now, up until this point, we've established what it looks like when God is when we're being the actor and director, correct? So now, we're saying that from this point on, we're sort of retiring from that sort of behavior and that sort of thought process, because ultimately, you know, we have our behaviors express themselves because of the way that we think and the way that we perceive things. You know, so ultimately we could stop behaving in a certain way. I could stop picking my nose, but if I still think picking my nose is fun, at some point I'm going to go back to doing it, correct? Mm-hmm. So ultimately I can cease the behavior, but unless I change the thought process that spurs this behavior, I'm going to continually repeat this behavior over and over again. I won't be able to abstain from it for any extended period of time. So I decide hereafter in the drama of life that God is going to be my director. So now I have to live as if God is my director, and there's certain things that I need to do in order to make that true. It says, He is the Father, we are His children. He is the principal, we are His agents. And of course, you know, and this was something that always confused me, because I didn't get the whole principal agent thing until like somebody who was in insurance explained it to me. The whole State Farm being the principal, and then like my agent, the guy I call when I like smack up my car, right? And so if God is like the hub and I'm following His direction, that's what that means. So it means that I have to stop listening to my mind. We were talking about worshiping the mind, worshiping our thoughts, worshiping our emotions. Now ultimately, I need to cease and desist with that sort of, you know, behavior. And When what that means is, at first it means that I need to, you know, act or walk as if the things that are going on in my mind are not true, and behave as if they're not true. And ultimately, at a certain point, you learn to be disciplined enough to really be, to recognize the difference between what is God-centered and what is, you know, Carrie-centered. But first things first is simply learning to walk through my life or participate in daily life without making every thought be a reality. You know, and we start by editing that. So like when I get this thought and I'm like, you know, they don't like me. So what? Does it matter? No. Okay. Go. Sometimes it's that simple. You know, and sometimes it's certainly more elaborate. And of course, the 10th step is really all about that. And each step builds on itself. And like, you know, when we really think about working, you know, living in 10, You know, that's really, you know, 6, 7, 8, and 9. You know, that's really what that is. You know, so when we're thinking about this, but we're looking at this and we're saying that these are good ideas and they're simple. That this is the concept of the keystone in which we should walk through a new and triumphant arch and we'll pass through freedom, right? So we're building an archway in which we shall enter the world of the spirit. And of course, Bill is using this heuristic because he knows that, you know, if we think of the steps as being a process or, a lot of times, I thought of the steps as being like a breaking down process, you know, breaking down the ego, breaking down, you know, the way that I see things. And part of it is absolutely, we need to do some sort of demo in order to rebuild. But it's truly more of a building or creative process than a destructive process.
I wanted to touch on that real quick because it's something that I get frustrated and I see it all the time in the fellowship and the perception of the general public about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we're powerless people, that we're hopeless people, that somehow we're defeated. And
South Park.
And absolutely.
Remember that episode,
absolutely.
South Park?
That's a perfect example. You know, Randy cruising around in his wheelchair saying powerless with the bottle of Jack in his hand. You know, this process is in fact about accessing power.
It's an empowering process.
And it tells us later on, you know, it talks about cease fighting everything and everyone, position of neutrality, safe and protected, you know, but it's all about getting that power. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a powerless aspect and a point where we need to rip everything apart in the very beginning and get to this point of hopelessness. But that's only one of 11 steps, you know. The rest of this whole process is all about building up and giving us tools to be happy, useful, productive, empowered people and not fear, you know, not be afraid, not worry about whether we're going to pick up, not worry about, you know, all the chaos in life. Excuse me.
So, a lot of people don't. I was explained to me that, you know, the third step is really a three-step process. There's three aspects to it. I need to be convinced of a bunch of crap before I even get here. Once I'm convinced that life run on self-will could hardly be a success by really looking through my life, you know, there's sort of an acknowledgement that this is true, right? Then it says, you know, how do we get God's help? So then the second thing that I need to do is start seeking God's help, right? So how do we do that? Well, obviously we take a third step and we're going to break down that contract because the third and seventh step prayers are contracts with God. We ask God for something, but we also have to pay a price. That's the way it works. There are no free lunches in Alcoholics Anonymous. So there's a contract that I make with God, and then I launch out in a course of vigorous action because and said, here's the how and why of it, okay, of getting God to relieve our self-centeredness, right? To getting help with this selfishness problem. Well, we have to quit playing God. Part of how we stop playing God is to see where we play God. To see in great detail what it is that I'm doing and take that moral inventory. So it's like one springboards into another and they're very much interconnected. So really, you don't take a third step till you put pen to paper. Because the words are meaningless without the action. Faith without works is dead. So in reality, you know, the three aspects of the third step is acknowledgement, the need for it, the contract I make with God, and putting pen to paper. So when I hear people say, I'm on my third step for a month, I'm like, no, you're not. You're in nowhere. You're on step zero. Because that's not a third step. A third step is done in a matter of 20 minutes at most, you know, and so actually third step is done through our lifetime, man, you know. Yes?
Sorry, I missed something. What are the three aspects?
First is the acknowledgement, right, that we need to be convinced that life run on self-will could hardly be a success, right? So we look at all that we just went through the actor and looked at all the reasons why life run on self-will, right? Okay, so then we have the contract with God in our third step prayer that we make. And then we put pen to paper with our fourth step.
Thank you.
You know, so it's a rather quick thing. It's not something we meditate on. There's no, I taking back my will. That's not what this is about. I don't know what my will in my life is in the third step. Mm. I have no clue. I'm a delusional motherfucker.
Yeah.
I need to write an inventory and do a fifth step because I lie in my inventory. And when I do a fifth step, and my sponsor listens to it and goes, yeah.
And the third step, too, though, is not necessarily giving up one's will. That's not what it's about. You know,
care up.
It's making a decision to seek the power.
Yes.
You know, we get into 11, and then we learn how to align our will with God's, and therefore giving up our will, quote unquote.
Nope.
You know, but it's not. It's changing our perception and changing what is important to us. You know, prior to 11, my will was to get what I want, do what I want, make you change the way I want you to change. By the time I got to 11, I wasn't there anymore. So, yeah, I wasn't really giving up my will, but I aligned it, you know, and it became one with God's. So I gave my will up and I took it back now. It's just crap.
So, you know, we have these results. Again, I don't like the word promises. We have the results. We have our third step promises. So here they are. When we sincerely took such a position, what position? Well, that God is our director, right? He is the principal. He is the father. We're the child. We are the agent. We're going to follow his will. That's the position that we take. Once we take this position, all sorts of remarkable things happen. New employer, being all-powerful, provide what we need. If we keep close to him, perform his work well. There's always a freaking contingency. Bill is not stupid. He's saying, well, you know, you'll have this employer. He's all-powerful, and he'll provide what we need if you keep close to him and perform his work well. What does that mean?
You got to show up.
Yes. It means that Allah can move mountains, but you need to bring the shovel. You know, and it says that established on such footing. What footing? Performing, keeping close to him and performing his work well. If I'm on that footing, I'll be less and less interested in myself, my plans and designs. I'll become more interested in seeing what I can contribute to life. As I feel new power flow in, I'll enjoy peace of mind. I'll discover that I can face life successfully. I'll become conscious of his presence and begin to lose the fear of today, tomorrow, hereafter, I'll be reborn. So those are the results of taking this action. But again, I don't get these results until I start putting pen to paper. Because that decision has no effect unless it's backed up with action. So then we look at the third step, and we look at it really quick. And the third step, did you want to throw something there?
We were now on step three. Many of us...
Now we're at step three, by the way. Just pointing that out.
Everything up until this point was the prep. You know, it was all the prep, and this is what got us to this place. Again, it's like we didn't read about step one until like page 30, you know, but it gave us 40 some odd pages worth of information to prep us for this. Same thing just happened with step three. We've got 62 pages of prep to get to this point. Now we're at step three, and we said to our Maker, as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou will. So God, take me, make me into what you want. You know, not what I want, but what you want. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Why? So I can feel better? No. That I can better do thy will. You know, take away my difficulties. Why? No. To feel better? No. So that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. This is all about me becoming of better use. Not so that I can get the buzz, not so I can feel better, not so my problems go away and life is easy. It's so I can be more effective and more useful to God. That's the contract she's talking about.
Yeah, so basically I'm saying fix me, but I'm willing to put in the work to do so.
And I'm willing to do what you want.
I'm going to pay the price to be free. I mean, that's one of the things, and we're going to talk about it in a few minutes, about, you know, one of the things about alcoholics, and when I'm sitting with an alcoholic in inventory, and like how they always leave the pocketbook in the third column empty. And I always think, I'm like, well, isn't time money? Like, how much time do you waste on this bullshit, right? Let me just point that out. And two, I'm often unwilling to pay any kind of price to be free. I want freedom, and comfort without being willing to put up anything of my own. And that's actually really contrary to the spirit of the step process. Every time Bill asks us to do something, he gives us a result. When he gives us a result, there's a requirement. And the same is it's the same for the third, and it's the same for the seventh step. When I'm asking God to restore me, when I'm asking God to fix me, when I'm asking God, I'm laying all this broken shit on the table, and I'm saying, God, I need help with this. There, I have to be willing to be able to meet with my own effort to face and be rid of or restore these issues, these areas. I can't just throw it on the table and say, I'm done. Just take me. You know, and I've heard people, and they're like, I've surrendered, and I'm surrendering every day. And I'm like, you have no concept what that word means. Because surrender requires sacrifice. You sacrifice nothing. You sit on your hands and you wait for God to fix you, and you do absolutely nothing to participate in your own recovery. That's not surrender. That's called being lazy. Let's make this clear.
Well, look at your experience with sponsees that you've worked with. You know, how many of come, I want to, and then they don't call.
Oh.
You know what I mean? It's the same thing. They're not going to get better. You know, I'm more than happy to call my sponsees. I do it all the time. But I call the ones who call me. You know, I don't chase down the ones who don't put in any effort. If I got a sponsee who calls me on a regular basis and I don't hear from him for a couple days, I give him a call. You know, if I don't hear from him or I know something's going on in his life and I know he's jammed up, if he's shown me in the past that he's willing to go to any lengths, I step up my assistance in that case, because I know he's in a hard spot. But the ones who wanna, but don't ever show up with anything, mm-hmm. They don't show up with any of their step work, they don't make the phone calls, they don't go to the home group, they don't do the things, the basic, simple things that we gotta do in the beginning, I don't chase them.
If you show up at my house to do step work without your big book, go home and don't ever come back. Seriously. It's happened. I just really looked at them going, are you kidding me? I didn't know I needed a big book.
Yeah. Hey. Now, I like the ones who show up for a fifth step without their inventory.
Oh, I've had that.
I had one show up with a list of names. I'm done. And he's got a list of names. I don't think so.
No.
You know, but so we thought well before taking this step.
Don't think at all. Just
making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. I like the fact that Bill threw in the warning clause after. You know, you took the prayer. Yeah, we just did. Oh, we thought well. I did. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as your wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional. So long as the idea, so long as we express the idea, voicing it without reservation, this was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, is felt at once. Over the years, after doing some step work for a little bit, I found it very useful to write my own third step as part of a kind of a third step exercise of revisiting the work. If you know, if you're doing it again, or it comes up again, and you, what do I do in a third step? You know, I found that was a useful tool. You know, change the wording around, make it mine, make it personal, keep the idea, you know, but change it and make it mine. So you kind of break it up a little bit. You know, also the idea that, you know, that we do this with an understanding person, but we meet God alone. You know what? It doesn't matter. You don't have to do it on your knees with your sponsor. You don't have to do it quietly in your room in a sitting position. You just gotta do it. You know, you just gotta do it. You get with God however you feel best getting with God. You know, my favorite place to do it is in the woods in my backyard. You know, I love doing my quiet time out there. I love doing my spiritual, my step work prayer stuff out there. And that's what works for me. You know, so whatever works.
So it says, next, we launched into a vigorous course of action, the first step, which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless it once followed up by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things which have been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to the causes and conditions. So now this is what this is all about. We need to get to the causes and conditions of why we are the way we are. And that's what we were talking about when we were saying, you know, a lot of times we miss the internal aspects of the steps when it when something comes up and it's like, oh, I turned my thoughts right to helping somebody else, and I don't look at and say, well, why did I think that way? Or what was I really thinking? You know, we really need to be able to do that, because, again, now we're going to get a better idea of really what we're turning over to God. What is it that we're asking God to fix? What are we offering? And then, you know, because we reaffirm this in 6 and 7, where we reaffirm, and this time we know damn well the condition of our lives, the condition of our spirit, the condition of our alcoholism, and now we're really asking God to help us. I mean, in the third step, we're really just saying, I don't really know anything about myself, and I'm a total absolute liar, and I'm delusional, and I'm incredibly selfish and dishonest, you know, and I need to, you know, I need help with this. You know, once we've been through 4 and 5, we have a better idea of what we're really asking God to do for us. You know, and we also have a better idea of what it is that we need to do to address our internal condition.
Just a question. How many in here haven't done inventory? Okay, cool.
Cool, right. Then we're not going to
go through that. Yeah, no, I just wanted to be sure on that, because it's like...
We have liars in here. Maybe point out to me, I've done one, but it's been probably 15 years.
Okay.
So I've got, like, a lot.
Very cool.
Because we were thinking about, like, how we were going to do this inventory thing in 4 and 5 and what we were going to talk about. And... we were thinking about talking about it in terms of, you know, not necessarily detailing each column. And, you know, one, I find that incredibly boring.
Well, we got the board.
Yeah. But more about, again, the spirit within the step, you know, and what it is that we learn from this. You know, It was something that occurred to me a little while ago, and this probably something occurred to a lot of people, but I'm not that bright. I always wondered, like, you know, ever think about, like, the way that the inventories are laid out in the book? You know, first we have resentment, right? And accessing resentment for alcoholics, that's pretty simple. I mean, we're pretty pissy people, you know. We are. You know, we have a list, we check it twice, we know exactly who's done what to us. We've been rationalizing our behavior and blaming other people for our problems for a really long time. So, like, that kind of list is pretty easy to do, right? And then we got this fear inventory. Now, the fear inventory is a lot more... certainly a much more intellectual exercise, because we're talking about... these are more abstract, concepts. I'm a resentment. I know I'm pissed. But a lot of times, alcoholics, we have a difficult time identifying fear. Most of the time, we identify the results of fear as opposed to fear itself. You know, like, we're angry, or I have anxiety. Well, you're afraid. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that. I thought I was anxious. I was angry. I was annoyed. And in reality, I was operating from fear. When we look at fear, we get a lot deeper, and we really look at what it is that's going on within us that's the engine of this spiritual malady, the engine, the driving force of our resentments, because you cannot have a resentment without fear. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've yet to sit down with somebody where they have said, I have a resentment, and there's not something that they're afraid of. I really believe that for me, fear was the driving force of my resentment. And then we have sex. Now, sex is a very difficult thing for a lot of us to talk about. Some of us. Not necessarily me. I really don't have a problem with that. But it's, you know, when you think about it, it's like a resentment, and then we do the fear, and then we get to the real, you know, the nitty-gritty kind of shame part of it. And we see both where our behavior in our fourth column of a resentment inventory, our beliefs about ourselves and God, And those things have kind of translated into more intimate relationships. You know, and then we had the harms done, which is kind of like wrapping it all up, just making sure we didn't miss anything. And I think that Bill was really smart when he did that, because, you know, when we're looking at our resentments, I mean, that's something easy for me to access. And then, you know, my fear is, you know, it's an intellectual thing and there's concepts to it, and it certainly takes a little bit of spiritual elasticity to see them. And then, you know, we take the two things that we learned there, the two, you know, the skill sets that we learned on those two inventories, and we address some of the most dark and difficult aspects of being a human being, you know, which is the expression of human sexuality. You know, and I think he was really smart in how he did that. And I think, you know, had he put the sex inventory first, I don't think any of us would have probably done it. Mm-hmm. You know, but each one brings about the other. You know, I sat down, I had a woman that I sponsor, and I just started sponsoring her. She had about 5 years, I don't know, and I started working with her, and she's like one of those I love Course in Miracles, but she's like one of those Marianne Williamson swilling Course in Miracles, big book thumpers. You meet them? You know? So she's always talking about accessing her power and manifesting the now, and I'm like, God help me. God help me. You know? And so she wrote this Moby Dick of a fucking inventory. Oh my God. Like, 5 spiral notebooks of resentment inventory. She comes to my house. And I'm like, oh shit. I only have 24 hours to hear this shit. I gotta go to work tomorrow. Like, what are we gonna do here? I'm gonna start like piecing through this inventory. And it's just like this stream of consciousness crap. And I'm like, what happened to the handouts I gave you? Well, I thought this was better. Really? You thought it was better? We're ripping this up right now, setting it on fire. Because this is self-indulgent, navel-gazing bullshit. There's a reason why we have inventory. And we use columns. And the reason why we do this, because we're modeling our resentment, we're modeling our 4-step on a business inventory. You know, and back in the day before Excel, they had ledgers. And the point of this is that we're supposed to take an objective perspective. We're supposed to take a step back and look at ourselves objectively. And when you're doing stream of conscious, navel-gazing, freaking child of God bullshit, writing essays on your character defects, you're not being objective. There's a point to this. I mean, there's a method to Bill's madness. There just is. So we slog through this inventory. We cobbled together some resentments, and we cobbled together some stuff. And I managed to pull together something that resembles some sort of resentment inventory with her. And I go, so I gave you the fear handout. What happened to that? Well, I didn't think I had to write a fear inventory because I listed all my fears on my 4th column of my resentment inventory. Okay. So when we sat down and read the big book and we talked about, and I went through all the instructions on how to write it, because you never get a 4-step from me without having to actually go through all of these paragraphs, page by page, paragraph by paragraph, sentence by sentence, detail by detail, instruction by instruction. So when we sat down and we went through exactly how to write the fear inventory, did you freaking miss that? Well, I thought I should just think about it. How's that working for you? Not too well. And that's the thing, is I think a lot of people, the thing that I run into in the fellowship is that people think that the only inventory they have to write is the resentment inventory. I don't know how many people have never written a sex inventory or have no idea what a sex ideal is. Mm-hmm. And then they want to know, like, why their life sucks. And I'm like, well, because you don't have access to the power, man. You're running on, you know, 3 cylinders instead of 6, that's why. Or 8, I don't know. You know, you don't have access to the power. And that's why your life sucks. You got enough information to know how bad it is and no power to fix it. You know? So, I mean, I can't explain how important it is to follow the instructions as they're laid out. Now, once you follow the instructions as they're laid out, I mean, you can always add the bells and whistles. I mean, You know, the extended third column, the extended fourth column, the theater of the lie. I mean, the BBA. Anybody use BBA? Big Book Awakenings inventory?
Mm-hmm.
They're wonderful. But they have a structure. The structure is the very simple questions and columns that are laid out in this book. From there, we can add, but we don't take away. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Big Book Awakenings. It's a step guide.
I don't necessarily run into those problems with my guys. I'm usually they usually have less rather than more.
Mm.
But but the one thing that I found is very useful when I explain what this fourth step is I explain it to them from the perspective of your fourth step is your outline, your fifth step is your report. You remember in school when we did a report, you know, like an oral report, and we had to write an outline?
Yeah.
Well, that's what my fourth step is. My fourth step is the bare bones, basic stuff. Just
the data.
Bullet points, the data, exactly. And then when I go do my fifth step, we can elaborate, and we can dig at it, and we go a little deeper. You know, I worked with a lot of chronic relapsers for a long time, and I didn't even tell them to write a third or fourth column. I'd tell them to go write a list of names and why and come back.
Because they just lie anyway.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so then what we do is we start talking about the third column stuff, and we start talking about the fourth column stuff, and I've got their inventory in front of me, and I'm writing stuff down. They're giving me the answers. I'm just pulling it out of them, you know. And that's what the guys. I don't do that with people who are sober and have done some work. But the guys who are these, they can't stay sober more than a week, you know. Those guys, you're rocking them through, and you give them a little bit of a hand, you know, with that stuff. Because I know me. I had no clue what was affected in my third column when I was first doing it. My emotions and the self-esteem and pocketbook, and it was all jumbled together. And it was all kind of like, you know, I couldn't figure it out. And I remember when I brought my first real, you know, big book four step to a sponsor, he took a red marker to it and just started crossing shit out. You know? That's wrong, that's lies, that's crap. And I was like, oh, great. You know. So I try not to do that to my guys. I'll just have them write column one and column two, and then we figure it out from there. But what she was saying about fear is to me, the biggest insight into myself and into my experiences happened in the fear inventory.
Yes.
You know, I don't know the format or whatever you guys use for fear inventory, but I like a four column fear inventory. The four questions is, you know, what is my fear? Why do I have it? How do I set the ball rolling? And what perhaps is a better way?
And this is all on Just Love Audio resources under the fourth step.
But I found that that's a really useful tool, because what it does is it also gives me, it shows me where my defects are, you know, in my fears. Because I see, in my resentment inventory, I see my selfishness, I see my dishonesty, my self-seeking, but I don't see the specific actions that drive what goes on in my life. How do I set the ball rolling, or how does self-reliance fail me? Is really where I see the day-to-day actions that I do, you know, and the things that I participate in on a daily basis that drive my fear. And what perhaps is a better way gives me a vision of what to do, you know, and how to behave when this stuff comes up. It's like she said also, I love the way Bill laid it all out in that order, because, you know, resentments and fear is why I behave the way I do in my sex relations. If I don't understand my resentment and my fears, my sex relations, I'm clueless, because, you know, I just do what I do. This is what I've done my whole life. This is the way I behaved. I remember getting sober and being involved in a relationship and acting the way I always did and not thinking anything's wrong with it, because this is what I've always done, and not knowing that there's another way, until I started to look at the resentments and the way I behaved and look at my fears and look at the way I thought and I felt, and then look at the selfishness and the inconsiderateness and the other stuff in the sex inventory, and now I can see where this stuff's coming from.
You know, it's funny because if there is a woman in the continental United States who had sex with an animal, somebody tells them to call me. Like, I'm like the chick that hears the inventory of all inventories. I mean, I'm not kidding. They'd be like, Dave does it all the time. Dave's always said, and like, it would be like, Dave told me to call you because I got some pretty heavy sex inventory. I'm like, oh God, was it a goat? What? What? I'm kidding, but I'm sort of not, actually. But, I mean, and because that's the thing, is, like, you know, I think, you know, in the book it talks to us, it says, you know, that that a lot of times we make, you know, we have the people who are, you know, like, say, oh, you know, sex is the lower nature. We have people who are, like, the straight pepper diet. And, of course, he's talking about the difference between, you know, very, very conservative and, of course, the Freudian perspective at the time that he's writing this. But I mean, I think a lot of people, I think a lot of alcoholics, that's an area where we're really kind of fucked up, man. And I think part of it is because of our inability to have intimacy. I think we have those intimacy issues. I think we have those insecurities, and we don't really know how to have relationships. We've been drunk for a really long time, and we're emotionally stunted. We're ruled by our mind. We worship our emotions, and we think at other people. So it makes it really difficult, you know, to have a relationship with anybody else when we're so busy having a relationship with ourselves, you know. you know, and our constant need to protect ourselves and our emotions and our little feelings. And when it's funny, because, you know, I'll talk to people and they'll be like, I was talking to a friend of mine, he's like, I don't want to have a relationship. I said, really? I'm like, well, why? He's like, well, they'll just, you know, we'll get together, we'll be really happy for 5 years, and then she'll cheat on me and I'll be hurt. And I'm like, okay. All right, so I'm like, let me get this straight. A girl you don't know, that you're not dating, will just, you know, build this incredible life with you for 5 years and then just decide to cheat on you for absolutely no reason, because why? I wasn't going there. Possibly. Maybe there's something wrong with your picker. But more than anything else, and I think that, you know, we're so afraid of being hurt that we forget to live. Mm. You know, and I'm like, so what? You know, if you have 5 years with somebody, you have an incredible relationship, who cares? Who cares? I mean, yeah, it sucks if somebody cheats on you, and it sucks to get your feelings hurt. It sucks. So? Like, are we going to sacrifice our happiness and contentment because we're afraid of something that might happen one day, possibly, with somebody we haven't met yet, and a relationship we never had? Think about that. But, I mean, alcoholics, we're like that, dude. Like, you know, like, I'm going to decide the outcome before I even get involved, and then I'm going to protect myself from this projected outcome, and then I want to know why I'm lonely. I want to know why I don't have any fulfilling relationships in my life. And I want to know why I'm sitting at home on a Saturday night, or why my hand cramps every day. You know, this is why. I'm serious. You know, so I think these are things that we, you know, we all struggle with, that sense of that absolute fear that if I get hurt, I can't handle it. You know, and it's been my experience that, you know, I've gotten hurt. Things have sucked. People have hurt my feelings. You know, bad things have happened in my recovery. So, I'm still here. I mean, nothing could possibly be that bad that I couldn't, at some level, make it through it. And I have to believe that. You know, so when I'm having those beliefs, when I'm, you know, letting my fear or my fear dictate my reality, you know, I'm limiting God, for one, just pointing that out. Because my God's a God who wants to see me happy, you know. And so I'm already deciding God's going to punish me for being happy by taking it away. You know, and those are things that those belief systems I really need to look at. You know, because those are the things that are keeping me from being effective in my life. And this is what we're looking at in the fear inventory, in the resentment inventory, in the fear inventory, in the sex inventory. You know, and we're creating this, you know, by virtue of looking at what we should have done differently, we're creating an ideal for what we want our lives to look at like, what we want our relationships to look like. You know, part of it is looking at our thought processes that are not working. you know, and then acquiring a new way of perceiving these things. And then I have to acquire a new way of conducting myself. You know, so I'm essentially rewiring my brain and my actions.
And the ideal, I remember addressing my first ideal. And, you know, for a lot of us, I know me, I never had a healthy relationship. Never. You know, I had fun, you know, I had some that were really, you know, had a good time, but they weren't healthy relationships. We were just two sick people that fit together, you know, and that's really what I had, you know. And so when I was first trying to mold this ideal, I asked people. I talked to people who had healthy relationships, who I looked at, and I said, you know what, they got something going on. You know, what they're doing seems to be working. What is the basis of this? Because I didn't know. You know, I remember being, we were, what, 6-7 years sober. I had to actually ask questions of what's appropriate and what's not. What's acceptable and what's not. Because I'm trying to change. I want to do something differently. But the God's honest truth is I don't know what the fuck I'm doing wrong. You know, I really don't. It's what my dad did. It's the way my mom reacted. It's the way my grandparents lived. It's the way everybody I knew lived that I watched. So I just kind of modeled my life, you know, by default, you know, against these people. And it wasn't working. So I didn't know what it looks like to have any kind of a healthy relationship. So I had to find out. I had to learn. And I had to practice, and I had to be willing to say, I don't know.
By the way, if you're going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous looking for people in healthy relationships, I would suggest that you check out Al-Anon. They're much better at dealing. Those are the relationship specialists. Those are the guys, like, go sit in an Al-Anon meeting. You know, seriously, like, you know, like, alcoholics were asked backwards and, like, were, you know, socially awkward and emotionally stunted. You know, the Al-Anons have been dealing with us for a really, 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 really long time and learned to somehow tolerate our bull crap. So, and a lot of times I actually found, you know, one of the things that was really helpful for me was actually talking to people who were in Al-Anon, either wives or family members or friends of mine who were, like, you know, very, very, you know, into the book, like, you know, the wife of you know, one of his sponsors who is a black belt Al-Anon. And saying, okay, so I need you to enlighten me because I'm an alcoholic, so I'm really stupid. How should I be doing this? And it's been really helpful, you know. So, I mean, so we don't always necessarily, like, because I'm sure you're sitting here thinking about your home group going, healthy relationships. Slim pickings.
Another thing that I really want to throw out here, and this has been kind of forefront in my mind lately for the past few months, is this line on page 69. It says, we are not the arbiter of any sex conduct. Okay? Now, I want to hit this from a couple angles here, though. Because, you know what? It's none of my business what kind of sex relationships you have. Okay, it isn't. You know, whether you're gay or straight, whether you like threesomes, whether you like orgies, you're trying. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you want to try anything, you know, you can be Jack Harkness. I do not care. Yeah, somebody got it.
Very cool. Doctor Who.
But, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's my responsibility to watch out for the newcomers. Okay. If I see somebody fucking a newcomer, I'm going to say something about it. I don't give a shit if you tell me I'm not your arbiter. You know, it's a vulnerable new person looking for help is not somebody we screw around with. And I truly believe this, and a lot of people hate me for it, but I'll say something about it. You know, give them a couple months. Let them get through the work. You know, let them get their head out of their ass. You know, but it's straight up predatory behavior, and I see it happen. And you know, there was a group out by me where we got sober that kind of reveled in this idea. You know, this is
a good
thing.
Yeah, they sponsored through injection.
You know, and And the argument was, and their justification for it was, is we are not the arbiter of anybody's sex conduct, so I can fuck whoever I want. Mm. And it's like, no.
I have a funny amends story about that. Can I tell that one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. The guy who started that meeting kept, like, scooping up my sponsees, right? Because there were, like, a lot of hot guys there, right? So my sponsees were really young, so they would, like, be like, they'd go to this meeting, you know? And I'd be like, dude, please, just don't go to this meeting, because, you know, I know what's going to happen. You know, and they keep going, because, like, you know, that's it was, like, the hot spot, the single spot for the big book young people, right? I'm like, God damn it. So he kept banging my sponsees, like, one after another. You know, and I'd be like, God. So finally when he slept with, like, this, like, she was, like, 17.
Who, Tristan?
Yeah. She was, like, 17. When a 17-year-old sponsee of mine. Well, Carrie got a little mad. So Carrie decided, I my cell phone at the time was restricted, so I called him up and I was like, stop fucking my sponsees! Click. I just got so I had to make amends to him. So I crank called this guy. Essentially is what I did. And then I got to amends. My sponsor was like, yeah, you know, you need to call him and make an appointment to sit down and make amends to him for harassing him and crank calling him. Like, shit. So I went and made direct amends to him, and
it's not an excuse, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just gotta, you know, I'm sure yeah. It doesn't happen here,
nope.
But you know, it does happen, and it happens a lot more often than we think.
Yeah.
And I personally feel, and it doesn't tell me in here, but I personally feel that as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, we need to kind of take care of that. You know,
quietly.
We wouldn't stand by and watch a pedophile scoop up a child. You know, when we walk into these rooms, do we have the emotions and the vulnerability of a child?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're crushed. At least I was. I walked in here and I was crushed emotionally. And if some, you know, hot cougar came up to me and, you know, and was giving me some kind of, you know, validation, I'm all in.
But that's how I got you.
Yeah, I'm all in. You know, but the idea is it's not that, you know, as newcomers we're not responsible for our actions, but we're easily manipulated as newcomers.
So,
and that's really what it comes down to.
So, I mean, again, you can take that how you want, but on the other hand, you know, there are all different kinds of things that, you know, you're going to hear. As far as taste, lifestyle, things like that. I'm from the New York area, so forget it. You know, I don't know about down south, but, you know, up north, there's not a whole lot of things you can't do. with that being said, you know, there are times when you're going to hear things that contradict maybe your own moral standpoint or your own values. And it's not my job as a sponsor to impose my values on somebody else. It's my job to ask them questions to help them to see their own truth. Mm-hmm. You know, and as long as their behavior is not affecting, and this is the thing, it says, we reviewed our, it says, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our sex life. We subjected each relation to the test. Is it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. So as long as my behavior is not selfish, and I'm not hurting somebody, if I want to fuck a light socket, then by all means. Seriously. That's really not anybody's business. You know, this is the criteria that we set. So when other people with different lifestyles that are very different than my own come to me with their stuff, I need to keep that in mind. You know, because by my judgment or my desire to impose my values on them, I can be doing them serious harm. You know, and that's, and the whole point of this is for us to develop this ideal. So we're supposed to do this. We're supposed to take this to meditation. We're to ask God to mold our ideals, to help us to live up to them. So there's two things we're asking. We're asking God for a vision or an ideal that we're supposed to that's supposed to be molded. But we're also asking for the power to live up for the, up to them, because it, you know, just like anything else, it's not a free lunch. I can't create an ideal and say, this is what I want. This is the laundry list of assets that I want in a mate. Mm-hmm. And not be willing to bring those very same things to the table. If I want something out of a relationship, I have to be willing to give it. One of the greatest things, and this is one of the BBA, a Big Book Awakenings, has this one question on their inventory that I love. And it says, you know, and it talks about what was your revelation. And basically the question is where am I being a hypocrite? Because almost any point in time when I have a resentment, I'm being a hypocrite. Because at some point I've done that very same thing. You know, I may not have stabbed somebody in the eye with the screwdriver, but I might have thought about it. You know, think about that. I mean, and so inevitably, there's some level of hypocrisy that I carry with me, that spiritual pride, that judgment that I carry towards other people. And really, this process, especially 4 and 5, is about taking that away, about leveling that playing field and being truly honest with myself and taking away that judgment. Taking away that superiority, that rationalization, that holier-than-thou bullshit I carry around to make myself feel better. Because deep down inside, the truth is if you knew who I am, you wouldn't like me. So I have to dress it up, and I have to push you away, and I have to create this wall and this persona to protect myself from what I perceive to be a threat, which is your rejection or your lack of validation. And ultimately, you know, our job is to start to see people, all people, as God's children, and not to see them in terms of judgment anymore. I mean, I still judge people all the time, but I recognize that judgment to be a fallacy, to be a delusion. Because ultimately, when I'm imposing my judgment on you, I'm holding myself up to the same unreasonable expectations, and I'm going to fall short. So ultimately, the more I judge you, the more I judge me. And the more I judge you, the more I judge you, judge me, the more I feel like shit. You know, if I could put that perspective away in almost entirety, I'm a lot easier with the whole, just the Tao of whatever, man. It be what it is. And working with that, and just saying it is what it is. We are how we are. None of us are perfect. We're never going to be. None of us are going to be perfect members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not going to happen. I'm not. I fall short all the time. This is not about being spiritual robots. This is about truly living on a spiritual basis and being effective in our lives and learning how to love one another and not impose our will and judgment on one another and being able to have intimacy. And intimacy is not sex. Intimacy is about trusting somebody else. It's about allowing yourself to be as vulnerable and, you know, every wart, every character defect, everything that you think is just so terrible about yourself, allowing another person to see it and accepting theirs in turn. It's not an easy thing, because when I see other people's faults, they threaten me, because it's my fear that you're going to hurt me. When I lose my fear of being hurt, and I'm able to walk through that fear and recognize that my fear of being hurt only causes me to be hurt, because I'm continually setting myself up to be hurt, because I'm constantly protecting myself out of fear of being hurt. Yeah, it makes sense, right? A little weird, but it makes sense. Yeah, do you want to... Okay. Do you guys want to open up for questions for the next 10 minutes?
Just because, you know, I've been wanting to stop at the end of each one, and we keep going over. So, you know, if anybody's got any ideas, any thoughts, any questions, anything, you know, just to kind of, yeah.
What page was that on that was talking about the, what was the sex?
The sex? 69.
Page 69.
Yeah, exactly.
I got that look. That was great. Don't even have to think about that one.
Yes. Something that I find really important that I feel like people never talk about or miss, like on page 70, there's a part in the book, and it's like, it says, if we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, mm-hmm. we are quite sure to drink. Mm-hmm. We are not theorizing. These are facts of our experience. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, like, I just, it's like, those people, you know, like the young, like, men and women in AA trying to get sober, mm-hmm. like, when we take advantage of them, mm-hmm. like, they're not going to drink. Like, we're sure to drink. And I just think that, like, sometimes people miss that. You know, it's like, I don't know. I'm a little attached to the subject, obviously. But I just mm-hmm. wanted to throw that out there because I think a lot of people try to defend bad behavior with the arbiter.
Of course.
And they never turn the fucking page.
I agree with your assessment of that, but that's kind of contingent on me. Okay, I'll use me as an example. I see a newcomer and, you know, I scoop her up and, you know, do my thing, and I'm working this deal.
Right.
I'm gonna drink. I'm not working this deal and I'm just kind of staying stuck at that one point.
Right.
I may or may not drink. I'm just gonna stay a sick fuck. You know, and because, you know, my old sponsor used to say to me all the time, how free do you want to be? Okay? I achieved a recovered state from alcohol at about a year sober, 2 years sober. Okay? That didn't mean I stopped being an asshole. You know, that didn't mean that I didn't have all these defects of character that I was acting out on. And I could have stayed stuck at that point. And I've met guys like that. You know, I'm sure you guys have met the one and done crowd. You know, and they're very much, we did it once, now we live 10, 11, and 12 perfectly, and we're such spiritual giants. And, you know, some of them are, but some of them are still stuck at that
phase. Those are the ones who keep sleeping with my sponsees.
Exactly. They're at that stage where they've recovered from alcohol, but not the ism. You know, they've been able to stay at that level of they want to be this free. They don't want freedom where there's no ceiling.
But also, I've had sponsees come to me where they've gotten involved with a newcomer, you know, and they've had time, and they've made that error in judgment, and they're like, you're going to fire me. No, I'm not. Let's sit down with page 69 and 70, and we're going to talk about it. And we're going to do an inventory, and we're going to say, okay, well, what's going on with you? Obviously, you had lack of power. Where is it? So, yeah, no, absolutely we treat it, you know. And it is, you know, when I'm working with somebody who's having a problem like that, absolutely. It's not just like, well, you're just going to drink. Good luck with that.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Honey, dude in the back had a question.
Ask them to say that prayer before they get to that step.
What? The third step?
No,
the resentment of resentment prayer?
Prayer for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and for strength to do the right things. That prayer, I give it to people even if they're not on that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
New,
of course.
And they're not sure what to do in a relationship.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. I mean, look, every single one of these prayers are useful at any point. Like, I put people in step 10 while they're writing 4. You know, like, you know, so, I mean, like, I don't have a problem mixing things up and taking things from other steps when they're useful. Absolutely.
Actually, that's a good example. I'm a firm believer in starting 10 and 11 when you start writing your inventory. Because, you know what, from just a practical standpoint, you know, I'm writing inventory, I'm getting pissed off, I'm upset, I'm stepping on the toes of the people around me. If I'm not cleaning it up as I go along, I've got a nice big pile of shit when I'm done with this one. You know, so just from a practical standpoint, you know, it's smart.
You saw a hand?
Yeah, the guy in the back that asked about 69 had another question.
Yes.
Well, I forgot what it was, but I remember what another one was.
That's okay.
Such an alcoholic.
This is Jack Parkinson.
It was a Doctor Who reference.
Okay. Yeah. Completely irrelevant to this step process.
You know, kind of like the Fight Club references and the Matrix references.
Snarky.
Other question that I had before was, I'm really listening to what you're saying.
Part of the question that I had before was, like, I've only been in love where it actually meant something to me a couple of times in my life. The rest of the time, I've just been seeking just women for physical pleasure, selfish reasons. And so, you know, party with and have a good time or see a movie and have fun, but I've never really, like, throughout my addiction been, and I've been hurt so bad before that I really want to get to the point to where I could just love and want one woman. And I imagine if other good-looking women walk by, I might look at them and say, yeah, you're cute, but my love with her overpowers that. But I just have a really hard time, and I'm hoping through working these spiritual steps that I can get to the point that I can allow somebody
to be transparent with me and me with them equally to the point that that is so real that I lose my desire to be a slut.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, notice it says sex inventory, not love inventory, for a reason. Because Bill assumes, and the process assumes, that through by virtue of applying these spiritual principles, we learn how to, what love truly is. And what we're talking about, when we talk about love, we're talking about spiritual love. We're talking about the willingness to put aside my own selfish needs for another person's spiritual growth. And we're talking about that you know, fellowship of the spirit love. We learn how to do that through applying these spiritual disciplines. I mean, that when we talk about our feelings not being fact, I mean, my feelings of love are often irrelevant because I don't act like I'm loving. I act like a douche and I say I love you. And so when we when we're talking about acting in terms of love, or talk saying about being loving, we're not talking about your feelings. We're talking about your actions.
Also,
our feet.
Also, one of the things you said, I've been dealing with this a lot lately with sponsees and stuff. It's for some reason this year has been the relationship year, you know. And I keep telling them the same thing. Water seeks its own level, okay? You want a healthy relationship. You want a healthy person in your life. You need to work on you. You know, my old sponsor said it to me. He goes, when I brought him my sex ideal of, you know, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this. He said, now be this. You're not going to get this until you be this. You know, and that's really what I've come to see is that, you know, when I'm a sick newcomer, when I was a sick newcomer.
Why are you pointing
at
me?
I found, you know, and as we grew, as I grew, as I got better, you know, there were times when we clashed big time because she had grown by leaps and bounds in one area and I was still stuck back in the other, and we were not seeing eye to eye on any level because I wasn't there. You know, I talked a little bit about it last night. You know, about, you know, that being blocked and being shut down and not being plugged into God and not knowing it. You know, when I was like that, she was off up in, you know, spiritual land, and I'm down here, you know, being a dick in a wallet. You know, and it was just, we weren't seeing it. You know, it wasn't happening. We weren't together for that year. We lived together. You know, we interacted to a certain degree, but we weren't together because we weren't on the same page. You know, fortunately, after that happened, I did some work, and obviously something shifted and changed inside of me, and I was able to kind of open up enough to allow God in to get me past that place, and I caught up, you know, or she slowed down. I don't know, you know, whatever the case was, is we started being at that same place again, you know, and that's really how it works.
Okay, one last question, and then we'll... okay, two.
Yeah. Oh, it's all you guys, so...
Yeah, go ahead.
One thing that I just wanted to say, I was here the first one when Mark did it, and 5 years ago, and something that totally changed my life. You were talking about a higher power and God, my not understanding. Mm-hmm. And I was still always wanting to understand God, and he said it's not the God of my understanding, it's the God of my experience.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's about relationship. Yep. And ever since then, what I've worked on is not understanding God. I'm like a CIA agent. Mm-hmm. I get my information on a need-to-know basis.
Yep.
It's about relationship with God.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that totally changed everything for me.
I love that. Absolutely. That's awesome.
Eric?
Mine's more of a general four-step. When you take new people through the steps, are you breaking it down column at a time and giving them assignments?
Yes.
Yeah. What's your time frame? I'm always curious.
Depends. And actually, we were talking about this earlier. It depends on the type of alcoholic, you know, whether they're type 2, type 3, type 4. Type 2 has a week to write their first resentment inventory, like their first column, right? You got a week, go write it, come back to me. And then got a week, go write your second column, come back to me. Got a week, go write your third column, come back to me. Fourth. So usually, like, they have about a week to do any of them. And that's my second, you know, the type 2 alcoholic. Type 3, they make my, we do steps 1, 2, and 3 in about maybe 2 hours. Hit our knees. They make a list at my kitchen table. And then I help them write their second column. They go away for a couple days, finish it up, come back with it, and then we write their third and fourth column. Type 4s, I mean, literally, they get out of detox. I scoop their ass up from the hospital. I ask them a handful of questions. I qualify them, make them hit their knees, and then they write their four-step. They don't leave my house. I kidnap them for the weekend, and they write their four-step. They leave their house, my house, and they're a mess. So then those tends to be the tight friends, and it tends to be basically how much power have you lost over whether or not you pick up a drink and live on a non-spirit, you know, the whole, like, thing is, like, the sliding scale and the living on a non-spiritual basis and how long that window until you drink again, you know, and based on that, that's the time frame. But typically, if you're just a run-of-the-mill 2 to 3, if you're 4 steps, you know, if you're not finished in a week with your first column of your resentment inventory, which is the easiest part, don't bother calling me back. You know.
I'm similar. I don't have it necessarily as kind of laid out the way she just did. You know, I work with every single person just a little bit differently. When we get together, we pray. You know, and I'm talking to title page. We, you know, I pray and I ask God to show me what we need to do. You know, and then I start to talk to them and try and find out a little bit about them and find out about their alcoholism, and that's kind of where it starts to come, and that's where it starts to flow. You know, some guys I'll bring through this book word by word, and it takes us, you know, what is it, 3 months, give or take, to read through the book, you know, once a week or whatever, and we do the whatever it asks us to do. With, like she said, the type 4 alcoholics, though, or the chronic relapsers, we kidnap them.
Yeah.
You know.
They stay on our couch.
Yeah. We kidnap them. We put them on the couch. We put them in the spare room. You know, we go.
Want to live with us for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. He detoxed on our couch and never left.
Twice. He came, detoxed on our couch, stayed for a year, slacked on his amends, relapsed. We detoxed him a second time.
Yeah, no. He
and he stayed for another year.
Yeah, he was bawling in the driveway. Yeah. It was really wild because he thought we were going to throw him out.
Yeah.
You know,
you're an alcoholic.
I was like, dude, either God's restored you to sanity or he hasn't. Either he's removed the problem or he hasn't. You know, ain't my place to judge.
Yeah.
You know, you got high, okay, big deal. You know, this is what we do. What are you missing? Let's get back on the horse. This guy didn't actually get sober until the middle of his fifth step. I was working with him, and we're reading through, and this is part of the reason that I don't like that cookie cutter version.
Sorry.
You know, not your cookie cutter version, the cookie cutter version of you got to read this, you got to do that. You know, I'm reading the book with him, and we're going through, and I'm thinking, oh, I should go back and give this guy all the information. He was one of the first guys I sponsored up in the Poconos, and he'd never read the book, so I figured he's got to read the book, and I got in my head with this. And as we're reading through it, he's picking up. And he's relapsing along the way, you know. So he detoxes, he comes back, we get back right into it, review a little bit of 1 and 2 and whatever. And he relapses again. He starts writing his inventory, he relapses again. We're reading, I started picking up the pace. We're gonna do our fifth step and the fourth step at the same time. He's still relapsing through this. He got halfway through his fifth step and he stayed clean. You know, I don't believe that if you relapse, it's you missed something in step 1. I believe in kind of reviewing steps 1, 2, and 3 if you're writing inventory and you relapse. But the answer is not in step 1. The answer is in step 12. Why do we keep going back? You know, we don't need to keep going back. We just got to review and keep reiterating this stuff. And eventually it's going to click. You got to get to God, though. You know, and you can't get to God until you get to whatever point it takes you to get to God. Typically for me it was 12. So
get them through and get them done as quick as humanly possible.
It's like the guy with the gunshot wound that goes into the hospital and the nurse says, sit back, relax, you don't need treatment yet. You know.
Because you're not dead.
You know. But
did that answer it? Was that helpful? I'm mean though. Like if you show up, if you show up to my house with a half-written second column, the easiest part of the fourth step, and you've been sitting on it for 2 weeks, forget it. Forget it. You have a size 10 up your ass.
That was, yeah, Loretta.
Yeah.
All right, we want a break?
Yeah. 15 minutes?
Yeah. Yep. 22.
This window. I had a girl.